Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with independent filmmaker William Greaves. He is visiting the campus to talk about his work, and we will hear about what he has done during the time that he's been making movies. He's an independent filmmaker based in New York. He's produced more than 200 documentary films, which have earned more than 70 International Film Festival Awards, also an Emmy, and 4 Emmy nominations. He was for 2 years executive producer and co-host of the Public Affairs Network television series Black Journal, which won an Emmy for Outstanding Public Affairs Television Programming. Much of his work deals with the lives and concerns of African Americans, and we'll spend some of our time this morning talking about his most recent project, a biography of Ralph Bunche, which was featured this year at the Sundance Festival. It also was shown on many public television stations around the country earlier this month, including ours. And if you didn't see the movie, you will have 2 opportunities today if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana. There will be a screening of the film this afternoon at 2:30 at the Afro-American Studies and Research Program at 1201 West Nevada in Urbana. And then tonight, as part of the MillerCom series at 6 o'clock, that'll be followed by a discussion at 8. And this will be taking place at the Crannett Art Museum in room 62. And both of these are certainly open to anybody who would like to attend. If you're interested in seeing the movie and then hearing some comments about it from Bill Greaves, you are certainly welcome to stop by either or both of those places. He began his career as an actor. He's been featured on Broadway, on television, and in film. He is a longtime member of the Actors Studio in New York. In fact, he taught acting for film and television for Lee Strasberg from 69 until 82 at the Strasberg Theater Institute in New York. And we're glad that he's here to spend some time with us. Questions, by the way, are welcome if you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for giving us some time.
Well, thank you for having me, David.
I know that before you became involved in the documentary on Ralph Bunche, you were aware of him, and other people certainly were. But I think it's a little surprising that the level of awareness about him is not greater, given the fact that during his lifetime, at least for part of his lifetime, he may well have been the most celebrated African American. Mm-hmm. And it seems a little surprising, given that now he has been to such a great extent forgotten. Mm-hmm. That seems to be one of the interesting questions about him.
Well, that's a question that many people ask. It certainly is a question that I asked a number of times, and it's the motivating one of the major reasons why we got involved in this project to begin with, because we say, how is it possible that this individual who has been so influential in the decolonization of the world, has been involved with Eleanor Roosevelt in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, has been very centrally connected with much of the UN programs dealing with peacemaking and decolonization peacemaking and peacekeeping. He set up the peacekeeping strategies of the United Nations. How is it possible that this man is forgotten today? You know, it really was a very nagging question, and I was able to capitalize on the fact that the Ford Foundation was interested in Bunche and had... a scholar in residence, Sir Brian Urquhart, who was a close colleague of Bunche. He was writing a biography of his colleague, and so I thought it would be a terrific idea to try to get the Ford Foundation to do a film on his life, and that's how I got into the project.
Mm-hmm. He was a scholar. He was a diplomat. He was a social scientist. He was very important he worked with Gunnar Myrdal on American Dilemma.
That's right.
He, and among other things, was the first person of color to win the Nobel Peace Prize. That was in 1950. 50 for work that he had done trying to mediate the Arab-Israeli crisis just the year before. This was in 1940.
Well, actually, that's the only time that all four Arab nations have signed a peace treaty with Israel. Abba Iban speaks about the fact that the armistice agreement that he had these nations sign was actually really a peace agreement, but his style was always low profile, and he called it an armistice as opposed to a peace treaty.
Mm-hmm. He apparently had the ability to, when talking with the people in this difficult conflict, somehow to make each party feel that he understood them.
Yes, well, that was one of his outstanding qualities and skills in totally relaxing each conflicting party and getting them to have full confidence in him and recognizing that he was going to be fair in his dealings with each of them. He was very, very adept and skilled, and actually was part of his personality anyway. He was a very relaxed individual, and he just seemed to be able to gain the full confidence of two diverse entities, even though they were in high conflict with each other. And he was able also to empathize with them and to understand the nature of their problems and their issues in a very substantial way that enabled him then to draft those kinds of documents that would meet with the acceptance of these two contesting entities.
Mm-hmm. And here it actually was an accident that he found himself in that role as a result of the fact that the man that he was partnered with on this project was assassinated. Mm-hmm. In fact, Bunch was very lucky that he was not riding in the same car the man. Yeah. It was just a matter of chance. He very well could have died at the same time.
Absolutely, it was a fluke. Actually, he had been asked by Count Bernadotte to stay behind and work on some documents before he joined him in Jerusalem and. When he finished working on these documents and he was on his way to join Bernadotte, it's when he learned that Bernadotte had been assassinated. And then the Security Council decided that they would nominate him as the mediator, and he replaced Bernadotte.
Mm-hmm. That do you, as you look at his life and look at the various turns that it took, are there other places where you think that chance or fortune played an important role?
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, actually, he was an extraordinarily gifted man. He was very, very, obviously very, very intelligent. He was at the top of his class, for example, in high school. He was the class valedictorian. Mm-hmm. He had the highest marks in his class. And then when he went on he got a scholarship to UCLA. And there again, he moved to the top of his class and ended up being the class valedictorian. During that period at UCLA, I mean, he attributes that whole UCLA experience to the formative major formative period of his life, other than with his family. Of course, his grandmother was a very, very powerful influence in his life because she had a tremendous commitment to education. But he was a natural leader figure, and he played ball, basketball, and football, and so on. He played on the championship team of UCLA for three consecutive seasons. He was a playmaker. He was a right guard. He then was had a scholarship to Harvard And there again, he was at the top of his class. I mean, he was a real high achiever, this guy. And so when you say, was it luck, yes and no. I mean, he was a person that people depended very heavily on for information. I mean, he was a repository of a lot of the early beginning discussions, a memory of the discussions and the various issues that were central to the setting up of the United Nations itself, because he was part of that UN delegation, U.S. delegation to San Francisco that were involved with the drafting of the charter for the United Nations.
You know, as I remember it, his he was born in Detroit. Mm-hmm. His family moved to Albuquerque, and then when his mother died and his father left, his grandmother moved them to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. This was at a time when there weren't a lot of African Americans living in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And he, as you say, he was the valedictorian of his high school class, but was not able to attend a citywide honored ceremony for all of the various valedictorians because he was African-American, and he got a scholarship to go to college, but it was an athletic scholarship. It was not, they didn't recognize him for his intellectual abilities, but for his athletic abilities. How does all of that add up in forming his personality?
Well, you know, I'm impressed with your scholarship. you certainly have done your homework because you hit a number of very critical points in Bunch's life. These injustices, shall we call them, power sources, energy sources, which motivated him to see what could be done to alter a lot of what the American political life was like. I mean, he... The body politic of America, as you well know, during the early part of the 20th century, was certainly in a very heavy apartheid bag. I mean, it was a very unjust society. And one of the things that disturbed him tremendously was what he called the gap between the American creed, Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and so on, the gap between the stated rhetoric of the American creed in contradistinction to what was going on the ground. He felt that there was quite a lot of dissonance there. And he dedicated his life to trying to close that gap, to make sure that America was the stated democracy that it purported to be. And so you will find that a line of thinking threading its way through all of the work that he did in his scholarship. You'll find it in his work at the OSS during the Second World War, and his work with the State Department as head of the colonial desk there. And then subsequently, when he moved into the United Nations, that is to say, he wrote those chapters of the United Nations Charter. Let's say he was the principal drafter of those chapters of the United Nations Charter that dealt with the self-determination, the decolonization of the world. He was then put in charge of the trusteeship department, division of the United Nations, and then subsequently became Undersecretary General of the United Nations and throughout all of his career. And he also was very involved with civil rights in America, but in a behind-the-scenes perspective, he was very much involved with that. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus, I should introduce again, is William Greaves. He's an independent filmmaker. He has produced more than 200 documentary films. We're talking a little bit here about his most recent, Ralph Bunche, An American Odyssey. If you didn't see it when it aired on PBS earlier this month. It'll be shown two times today on the U of I campus this afternoon at 2:30 at the Afro-American Studies and Research Program, and then tonight at 6 at the Krannert Art Museum. And following the 6 o'clock showing, Mr. Greaves will be talking about the work, and so you'll have an opportunity to meet him and talk to him and ask questions. And, of course, questions are welcome here, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. As I mentioned at the beginning part of the program, you started out as an actor. Mm-hmm. How did you become interested in doing documentary films?
Well, very interesting. Concurrent with my work as an actor in film and television, stage and so on, I found myself studying African history in Harlem at the Ethiopian library there. It's no longer in existence. And I studied ancient African history with a marvelous, marvelous scholar named William Leo Hansberry. And he took us back, way back into antiquity, thousands of years of Ethiopia and into the Azanian civilization and the Zimbabwe and the Monomotapa Kingdom and Benin and Ife, all of these various names that were entirely at the time foreign to me. I realized that there was a defect, a serious chronic defect in the educational systems of America, that I, as a young black kid, didn't know anything about these civilizations. All I knew about Africa was the fact that they were a bunch of savages running around trees and turning into pancake syrup and being called Black Sambo and all of these stupid appellations. And also, my attention began to also focus on Hollywood, on the imagery that was being depicted of the Black American, and also the fact that I myself was being asked to play these buffoonery roles from time to time, which I always routinely turned down because I thought they were obscenities of the highest order. And that made me angry, that the communication systems, Hollywood and television and so on, theater, as well as the official stated academic institutions were derelict in their portrayal of the African American. And of course, what happens in a situation like that, if you make enough fun of people, if you stereotype them and you postulate the theory that they're a bunch of criminals and all of that, it's a very excellent philosophical basis for oppressing the people, you know, and it opens up the door for a lot of prejudices that really do not help the American social experience or political experience. Mm. So this is my upset and annoyance and anger from time to time led me into thinking that I'd better spend my time behind the camera making movies and particularly documentaries, which are routinely much more centered on factual truth, information, dissemination of that. I decided that it would be better for me to spend my time making these films, so at least there would be some kind of balance. I mean, but of course, I'm only one person there. Fortunately, there are other black filmmakers now who are similarly disposed. Mm.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. This person is in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello. Is there a caller there? Line number one?
Hello. Line number one is Urbana.
Oh, well, my apologies. Go ahead.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask if another African-American of roughly the same period who was probably all equally or more celebrity than Ralph Bunche was Paul Robeson. Did Ralph Bunche ever have any contact with Paul Robeson, and was there any relation between the two, and what were their attitudes towards each other?
Robeson and Bunche were quite friendly. Bunche had met Robeson in London, actually on Bunche's trip to Africa and his first and second attempts, scholarly research projects, connection with his doctorate that he was getting from Harvard University. So he knew the Robesons. He met them there. They became friends. As a matter of fact, he borrowed Aslanda Good Robeson's, that's Paul Robeson's wife's, he borrowed her motion picture camera, a Cine Kodak Special. It was a 16-millimeter camera. And he took it with him on his anthropological research in Africa, and did quite a bit of filming. He shot something like 10,000 feet of film in South Africa and in East Africa and so on in Southeast Asia. And they were friendly, and he was very, very appreciative of Robeson's interest in the self-determination of people of color throughout the world, which, of course, Robeson was heavily committed to.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just, we're getting some more folks here, but I'd like to, for a moment, return to the subject of documentary making. It is on one level a work of journalism, but I'm interested in perhaps how your experience as an actor leads you to think in particular ways about telling the story, because after all, if you don't engage the audience, they're not going to watch it. So there has to be, I would imagine there has to be some element of drama to make the subject matter compelling enough so that people are going to watch.
Well, you've got that right. it's quite true that thanks to my exposure to the theater as an actor, as you say, being with the Actors Studio, I've been a pupil of Elia Kazan, Lee Strasberg, Daniel Mann. I mean, these are very fine theatrical talents. I've always tried to find those elements within various documentary situations which have inherent in them dramatic possibilities, because operating on the theory that unless the audience is emotionally, psychologically, empathetically involved in what's unfolding on the screen, you have a real problem moving information into their heads. One of the big complaints of many documentaries, against many documentaries, is the fact that they tend to be dull, plodding, you know, intellectually based without any kind of pizzazz, if you will. My our documentaries, on the contrary, always seek to tap into the emotional areas, the subconscious areas of an event, those events, those elements that will, in one way or another, involve the emotions, the subconscious, as well as the conscious attention of audiences. And we do that through the use of sound effects, music, choice of the particular sequence that you're going to focus on, the content of the interview that you're doing with a particular scholar. You try to, in one way or another, get that scholar or that witness to this particular event to be relaxed and also to be personable, to finding things to ask that person which would tend to make them much more involved emotionally in the situation that you have under discussion, so that the confluence, the coming together of all of these elements on the screen helps an audience to focus and be very attentive, and even at times to be magnetized and terrifically involved in what's going on the screen. Now, one of our films, Ida B. Wells' A Passion for Justice, mm-hmm. we use, for example, Toni Morrison, reading from the diaries of Ida B. Wells. And Toni does a fabulous job. And she, of course, started off many years ago as an actress at Howard University. She was in the theater department there and so on. And she was able to read these diaries in a way that you were, you know, you often thought that Toni Morrison was Ida B. Wells, which was just marvelous. So that was a major contribution to that film. We had Al Freeman Jr., who was a wonderful actor, doing the narration of the film. And he, again, was very, very persuasive as the narrator. So the film won over 20 film festival awards. And I must say that I, every time I see it, even now, we just showed it last night at the university. It was, you know, it's a very... a moving piece of work, if I do say so myself.
Well, let's talk with someone else here. Line number two, this is Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a kind of a trivial question and one that related to some possible projects that you will be doing in the future. And the first was when you were describing your own educational experience with a world history teacher named Dr. Hansberry. Any relation to Lorraine?
Yes, he was her uncle. They're both passed away. Yes, her uncle.
Everyone knows who Lorraine Hansberry is, right?
Well, I would hope so.
They better, darn it.
Yeah, sure.
The second...
Raising in the Sun, signing Sidney Bluestein's Window, and so on and so forth.
The next question I had had to do with, I'd like to hear, of course, more about Dr. Bunch, but I don't feel any knowledgeable of it, so I'll just have to shut up and listen. But I would also like to know what your plans are, because obviously you're a very gifted human being, what you plan on doing next. And one of the proposals I would like to hear you comment on would be, do you see a story, a documentary, some form of support for looking into the story for the possibility of reparations, what Randall Robinson calls the debt.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, reparations is an issue that seems to be slowly, it started off in a glacial state, but it seems to be gaining increased momentum in the consciousness of the African-American community, simply for the simple reason that, of course, it is a reality that 400 years of unpaid labor is something worth contemplating. But beyond that is the fact that there are these reparations being given to various groups throughout the world today in regard to various injustices that have been perpetrated, and I think that it's certainly worthy of a film. I just personally have not had that much of an involvement in that particular issue, but I certainly think that more films. I don't know how many films have been done on it at this point, but certainly there should be a number of films done on that particular issue, because it's a very, very serious issue, and one that, unhappily, most Americans prefer to forget about, because the debt is so enormous. I mean, you're talking trillions of dollars here, you know, when you sit down with a calculator and start calculating the number of hours that were put into slave labor over a 400-year period. I mean, you're talking money. And I think it's one of the reasons why there's a psychological block in the minds of most Americans with respect to reparations for African-American workers prior to the emancipation of, after the Civil War.
Well, I think if ever you or one of your cohorts in the film industry, particularly documentaries, please be sure to look at all of the corporate benefactors, like Aetna Insurance, from insuring the property of the plantation owners, and all of the manufacturers that laid claim to guarantees of faster production and things like that, that it draws them more in that this is mainstream America that managed to profit from this.
Yeah, well, you know, you sound like you'd be a very good research resource for this project. You've touched a number of very intriguing ideas, and I will pass this along to friends of mine, both black and white. I think this is a I don't think the film should be confined to black filmmakers. I think white filmmakers really have a much larger responsibility in this area than blacks, because unhappily they belong to the group that profited most.
I would like to see your movie on Ralph Bunche, and I this sounds like something that public television would embrace, I would hope. Certainly here in town.
Well, done already. We aired it here twice already this month.
Oh, my gosh. Am I ignorant or what? I'm sorry.
But there are going to be two. I mentioned a little earlier, yeah. they're going to show. There are going to be two showings on the campus today. So you'll have two chances to see it.
Also, I should mention that, you know, public television is driven by market forces in a sense. Yeah. And so if the listenership wants to see the film on television, all they have to do is pick up the phone and call the neighboring television station, and the number of calls that come in are the determining factors of whether or not they will program that film again. So anyone who wants to see Ralph Bunche, American Odyssey, narrated by Sidney Poitier, incidentally, a wonderful. Have you seen it, David?
I have to be honest with you, I haven't seen
yeah,
it.
Yeah, gee, you should see it, because Sidney does a fabulous job in narration of the film. Mm. But anyway, calling in the station will certainly help to have a reprogramming of the film.
How long is the film?
It's a two-hour special. It's a primetime two-hour special, and it's theoretically it's supposed to have played on the 350-plus television stations throughout America during primetime. But I understand that some of the stations have not programmed it during primetime, but have programmed it sometimes like on Sunday afternoon and that sort of thing. But I think that most of the programming has been on prime time.
Well, I'm going to have to just figure out how I can get through my schedule today and get over and at least see it.
Okay.
Sounds like it would be worth my vision.
Come on over.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
All right.
Well, I do want to, again, maybe I should introduce our guest and also give the information on people who are here in Champaign-Urbana if they'd like to see the movie we've been talking about. Our guest is William Greaves. He's an independent filmmaker. He has produced more than 200 documentary films, won many international festival awards for his work. He was nominated for 4 Emmys and won one Emmy for a series that he was involved in, a network television series, Black Journal, which won for Outstanding Public Affairs Television Programming. His most recent film, the one we've been talking about here this morning, Ralph Bunche and American Odyssey, it did run on public TV stations earlier this month. But if you didn't see it, you'll have a couple of opportunities. This afternoon at 2:30, it will be shown at the Afro-American Studies and Research Program at 1201 West Nevada in Urbana on the campus. And then tonight at 6 o'clock, this is part of the MillerCom series, at the Krannert Art Museum, room 62. Following that at 8, there'll be a discussion. So, again, if you didn't have the opportunity to see it, you can try and take in one of these two showings. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One of the things I know is that you, at the beginning of the project, you were hoping for a six-hour film, and yes. Then it had to be cut to 4, and then it had to be cut to 2. And believe me, I know how painful a process this can be. You become so absorbed in the subject
absolutely.
That it gets to the point where the idea of cutting something, it's like cutting off a part of it.
Oh, certainly. You know, we had already brought the film to a rough cut, rough fine cut stage in the six-part incarnation. It was six one-hour segments. Then we had problems getting funding, as well as the fact that one of the arguments levied launched against the project was that the casual television viewer would not sit still look at six hours about a person that nobody really knows anything about. Mm-hmm. That the name recognition of Ralph Bunche was so low at that point that it would not hold the TV audience. Well, I mean, the whole function and purpose of the whole project was to increase the name recognition for the casual viewer. But anyway, we were then forced to cut it down to 4 hours because we thought we could get funding for 4 hours. Well, we got some funding for 4 hours, but not the complete funding. So we then went and cut it down to 3 hours, and we involved the Cosbys, for example, and they helped to provide funding. Of course, we got funding from the MacArthur Foundation here in Chicago. We had funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities, from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting, and National Black Programming Consortium. And so we were moving toward getting all of the completion money, but we couldn't really finish it until we got it down to 2 hours. I mean, because with the funds, the completion money that we were offered by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was based on our ability to cut it down to 2 hours. Well, you know, as you say, it was a painful, agonizing, time-consuming and absolutely almost debilitating experience. I mean, enervating to the extreme. We just had to spend an awful lot of time figuring out a way to tell this story, knowing how massive it was. I mean, you mentioned Gunnar Myrdal, for example. We were forced to leave out the whole Gunnar Myrdal experience, which was the definitive work he did called An American Dilemma, The Problem of the Negro Question in America. That was the official title. It was a very important work, which was central to a lot of the thinking in academic circles, in public policy circles for quite a number of years. Very important document. And Bunche was very central to the writing of An American Dilemma, which most people are not aware of. And we had to leave that out. We had to leave out his second trip to South Africa. I mean, to Africa. We had to leave out his marvelous collaboration with Eleanor Roosevelt on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That is collaboration in terms of helping to get the UN General Assembly to, you know, endorse it and so on. So there are all of these areas. Vietnam, we don't get into the intrigues of the Congo. We didn't get into his setting up. A lot of people don't know that he set up the UN Atomic Energy Agency for Atomic Energy, Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy. He set up that agency. He was very much involved with Dag Hammarskjöld. They were a binary star entity. They worked very closely together, and also with U Thant. So there's quite a bit. And, of course, Brian Urquhart, who was the colleague of Bunche, Sir Brian Urquhart today, was very privy to a lot of this, and it was indeed a very, very valuable resource for this film, because the film is based on his book, Ralph Bunche, An American Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And Brian really knew a lot of the ins and outs of Bunche's life, and also the intrigues and God knows what else of the United Nations. It was a total delight working with him. Because he really opened up a whole world to me, the UN. I had worked at the UN myself at one time in the television and department, and film and television department. And but I didn't have any idea of what was going on in the citadels of power at the UN, you know, where you get these top-level strategy discussions that go on up there in the higher echelons. And Brian was marvelous in giving me the insights that I needed desperately in order to put the film together.
We have some other folks to talk with. Let's do that. Next is a caller in Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Simply wanted to thank you. The program was splendid. it's a shame that so much was left out.
Yeah.
If you can revise it and restore it someday.
Well, happily, we do have some help in that direction. We are embarked upon the, we're soon to be embarked on the production of some teaching modules, video modules, which will focus on those moments and issues of Bunch's life that had to be left out of the two-hour special that's currently on television. We've had some wonderful assistance in this direction from the Carnegie Corporation and also from the Rockefeller Foundation and, of course, from the Cosbys.
Well, thank you.
All right. Let's go to Winnebago here for somebody else. Line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'll try to be brief. You're addressing my question also, I think. And it's this program is absolutely marvelous, riveting, and I certainly would love to see the complete thing because it sounds like you left out the best part. Just marvelous. And you mentioned Brian Urquhart, and yeah. There must be some string of coincidence there because you remember the trilogy that included House of Cards with Ian Richardson mm-hmm. playing a person named Urquhart, mm-hmm. and they looked for all the world identical. Mm-hmm. What was the link there? Pure coincidence?
Well, unhappily, I mean, I'm vaguely know of what you speak. I frankly don't have any information on that, other than the fact that I do know that Brian was the not prototype, but he was the model for one or two novels that were written that related to the United Nations. But I just don't know the details of that, so I beg forgiveness.
It was just marvelous mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. in both cases you're talking about the diplomatic maneuvering, mm-hmm. and someone must have studied Brian Urquhart and got him for a model. It's just absolutely great, and he contributed very much, I thought, to this program.
Mm-hmm.
I can only hope that you will make a director's cut for the rest of us to see some of these things.
Well, one of the elements of my agenda on the film is to not only do the educational modules, which are going to be part and parcel of the educational outreach of the project, which go to schools and colleges and universities and special interest groups, particularly those interested in conflict resolution, one of our objectives is to come out with the four-part series, which is a much more comprehensive, in-depth, fulsome portrayal of Bunch's life. But I have to tell you that I'm delighted at the way in which the two-hour special is being received. We had a standing ovation, incidentally, at the Library of Congress. Dr. James Billington, the Librarian of Congress, personally hosted a VIP reception for the film. And there was this standing ovation, and then subsequent to that, there was a symposium the next day moderated by former Ambassador Donald McHenry, and Sir Brian Urquhart was also one of the panelists, and Dr. Ron Walters, and a number of, and a couple of other people, Benjamin Rivlin and Robert Edgar, were also on that panel. It was a very stimulating panel in which Bunch's life was discussed. I should also say that Kofi Annan and his whole entourage came to the City University Graduate Center to see the one of the previews that we did of the film, and they were very enthusiastic about the way in which the whole UN experience was depicted in the film.
Well, congratulations, and for anyone who hasn't seen this, they're missing something. It was really... I've just been thinking about it continuously for days.
I hope. Have you read the book? Have you read Brian Urquhart's book?
No, I only saw it. I get Madison, public TV.
Uh-huh.
And
oh, you saw the film?
Yes.
Oh, good.
It's just, yeah, you can't forget it once you've seen it. So thanks again.
All right, thanks for the call. I wanted to, in the last few minutes here we have left, I wanted to have you talk about more about something that you've touched on, and that is the fact that for independent documentary makers, it is becoming harder and harder to get funding. Mm-hmm. And if you, in fact, you look at the kind of things that do get, that catch people's attention and that get funding, it seems that there are pieces that, I'm not saying that they're not worthy of being done, but they're pieces that by their subject matter tend to be extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And something that, and it seems to me, things that are sort of more traditional mainstream documentaries, the people who make those kinds of movies are finding it very difficult to get the money to do them. What's the funding picture look like these days?
Pretty dismal.
That was my impression, yeah.
Yeah, no, the there has been, unhappily, an inexorable movement toward decreasing the incidence of funding for the documentary film sector of the motion picture industry. This is the sector that's very much involved in advocacy rights of one kind or another of different issues. It's the sector of the motion picture industry that is most concerned with, shall I call it, the truth. And it's it is that part that is tied also to what we have constantly been referring to as First Amendment rights, the ability for the American people to have vocally expressed in the media a lot of the various issues that are part and parcel of the American body politic. And there seems to be an attempt to constrained to hold back that part of free speech in America, if you will. And that translates into decreased funding right across the board throughout the foundation world, and but more particularly in public funding, for example, at the National Endowments and for the arts and so on. So that it's not a very happy experience, because if it succeeds, if there is less and less of this truth coming out on the screen, I mean, what are we dealing with? We're dealing with a lot of silly, I'm sure they'll forgive me, hip-hop and God knows what else, programming, but programming that are comedy-based. You know, American people are constantly, ha-ha, every time you turn on the screen, everybody's laughing. Well, you know, there's some serious things going on here, and I think it's important that the documentary filmmakers have the ability to, through financing, to make films that address the needs and interests of the American community, whether it's black, white, Latino, Asian, whatever. These various communities need to be heard from, the disabled, people involved with, who have concerns about AIDS and so on. All of these areas need to be looked at in a very aggressive way.
I'm sorry to have to jump in on you, but we're going to have to stop because I've used my time. But again, for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, two opportunities today to see Ralph Bunche in American Odyssey, a film by our guest, William Greaves. This afternoon at 2:30 at the Afro-American Studies and Research Program, tonight at 6 at the Cranford Art Museum, following that, a discussion with the filmmaker. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, David, for having me.